body. Thank you for tuning in to What's Really Going On. I am your host, your queen, the educator extraordinaire, Dr. Sonya Whitaker. And I want you to know that it is on this show that I will continue to shine a spotlight on any and all issues that directly or indirectly impact public education. Be sure to not just listen to the radio broadcast, but call into the station at 563-999-3728. I am also just way too excited to share that you may continue to gain access to my live broadcast, which take place at 9 a.m. every Saturday, as well as my on-demand archive broadcast by simply logging into my website at SonyaWhitaker.com. You're also encouraged to follow the show via Facebook Live on my public Facebook page, which is Dr. Dr. Sonya Whitaker, so that you may add your valuable comments while the show is actually ongoing. You see, by adding your comments relevant to the topic of discussion, we will be able to harness our collective intelligences for the purpose of restoring hope in our schools and in our communities.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, beautiful people. I am so happy that you have decided to give of your gift of time. Like they say on the airplane, when you get ready to take a flight, or actually at the end of the flight, they end by saying that there are many different airlines that you could have flown on this occasion, and we're thank you for taking the time to spend time on our airline. And so that's how I want to open this morning, by saying I recognize that there is much you could be doing with your morning. 2 weeks ago, I talked about how important it was to build your intellectual capacity by being clear and careful about who you allow to influence your thinking. And so the mere fact that you have decided to join on with me and my guest, Dr. Jason Otley, today, I think I speak for both of us when I say that we are humbled by the fact that you have indeed selected us to spend your time with today. With that being said, I'd like to pause for just a moment. I would be remiss if I did not stop to acknowledge the hardships. If there is a word to describe, I don't even know that hardship right now is even deep enough to describe what the citizens are experiencing in Texas right now, relevant to the winter storm, which, as we are aware, has caused major power outages, no water, and the like. As opposed to running down the list of hardships, we want to start on a high. So I won't do that, but I will ask for us to just pause for a moment and them in our thoughts and our prayers. I'd like to, before I read the bio of my distinguished guest today, which I'm so humbled, Dr. Ali, that you've agreed to be with me, I want to share with the listening audience how important it is that we all recognize, this is what's on my spirit this morning, that we all recognize that we can share this space. That is like so on my spirit this morning, because as I began to put out on social media who I was going to be interviewing today and the like, much like in the past, people reached out to me prior to being on the show. And I had probably between yesterday and today several, maybe 5 or 6 conversations about people wanting to connect with each other, people wanting to connect me with others. And I must admit, it was probably this time yesterday that I thought, like, what is that about? And so that's where my spirit got to the point where I really digested this notion that there is enough room, there is enough space in this world for all of us to work individually and to combine our intelligences for the purpose of catapulting equity work to the next level. One of the things that I'm also appreciative of is how many people are actually watching. Sometimes they're like silent watchers. And so, again, I'm excited about my guest today, and I recognize that even though we don't see everyone's faces, you're out there. I got a message today at 8:22 a.m., and I won't read the name of the lady who sent it or her school board, but it came in at 8:22 on Facebook as I was putting the finishing touches on my notes today. And she says, "Thank you, Dr. Whitaker, for everything you do. I am a school board member in school district XXX. She says, "I have seen you speak, and I love all of your discussions. Thank you for your inspiration, which I emulate on the school board. You are the best." And so I share that, again, as I introduce my distinguished guest in the spirit of where my mind and soul is right now, relevant to the fact that I have come to terms with the fact that there's enough for all of us. But I also want to add another caveat to that, which is that people are watching us, Dr. Otley. People are watching us, and they're looking for advice at the teacher level, at the school board level, for how to take this work to the next level. And what I've been most amazed about, it's not just black folks. It's white folks too, Asian folks, and Latinos who are saying, "How do I do this work?" And they're looking for opportunities to learn about how to get it done. And so I'm excited to introduce to you my special guest, Dr. Jason Otley. Dr. Otley is the executive director for the Bond Educational Group, a nonprofit organization that invests in the lives of the underserved communities through education and entrepreneurship. He is a race scholar positioned to change the way schools and organizations function by revising policies and practices entrenched in white supremacy. As a college professor, he has over 15 years of extensive research in developing race-conscious programs and culturally responsive or culturally relevant pedagogy. Dr. Otley holds a Ph.D. in educational leadership and policy from West Virginia University, a master's in education degree in special education from George Mason University, and a bachelor of arts degree in English from West Virginia University. During this broadcast, we will talk about a lot of stuff, but we will also engage in a conversation about the importance of developing policies and implementing practices which can move schools and districts closer to achieving the goal of equity in education. Dr. Otley, let your voice fill this airwave. How are you today?
Dr. Whitaker, good morning. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on your show. You mentioned time being the greatest commodity. I totally, totally agree. I'm just thankful for the listeners who are listening in today, and I value your time just as much. And so I'm looking forward to this rich conversation between Dr. Whitaker and I.
Thank you. So I'll let the listening audience know that our spirits are connecting in that we had an opportunity to meet for the first time just a few months ago. The National Association of Black School Educators, also referred to as NASE, is doing similar work. And Dr. Otley and I had the distinct honor of meeting on a panel where we both contributed to that conversation. So I'm looking forward to doing so today and to continuing to grow with you. Dr. Otley, can you tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Absolutely. So about me personally, I think it's so important to add personal touches to who you are professionally. Born and raised in Washington, D.C., in an era where D.C. was the murder capital of the world. Y'all probably remember those who watched the news or lived nearby in the 80s. And so it was very tough on the block that we grew up in. And so our neighbors were constantly getting robbed and cars stolen and just people hanging out late at night and just doing things in the city that my father was just like, "I got to get my family out of the city." And so he moved us 90 miles west to a place we had never even heard of. In geography class, we learned about the 50 states, and this is a state that I never even remembered. It was called West Virginia. And so we spent most of our teenage years in that area. And I will say, Dr. Whitaker, that was a game changer for me because I was able to begin to appreciate the difference in culture, right? The difference in backgrounds and nationalities and ethnicities, and really be exposed I think the operative word is exposed to a world that I didn't know existed. All that I knew was life in D.C. I didn't know about a different world. And so that was the catalyst for things like studying abroad. That was the catalyst for things like getting a passport and going to visit other countries, a catalyst to do things that I had never even considered doing before. And so that was a springboard, really, for where I am now. Went to school and got a degree in education because I just love people and I love to teach. I was the oldest of four boys, and so I felt like I was always teaching and coaching them. And so why not teach and coach students? I taught high school for several years and was a dean of students, assistant principal, vice principal, and then said, hey, I want to do more. I want to be able to impact my community specifically at a larger table. You mentioned there's so much room at the table for all of us. Dr. Whitaker, you're absolutely right. But I think that there needs to be more of us from our community at these tables making decisions. And so I went back to get a PhD because I recognized there was a lot of policy that needed to be changed in order for communities of color to really thrive and advance in their lives. So after my PhD program, I created a nonprofit organization called the Bond Educational Group with some great friends and colleagues. This is not a work that I do alone. It's a bunch of us. And the Bond Educational Group focuses on education and entrepreneurship. You may wonder, well, so many different organizations focus on education. The part of education that we focus on is helping you to thrive and helping you to find your voice post-college. And so many organizations may help you to get access to college, but we help you thrive in college. The retention rates of African-American males who attend predominantly white institutions is nearly 50%. I mean, 50% end up dropping out after their first year. Well, we create programs in which to help communities of color thrive in college, find their voice, and then gainful employment when they finish. And then the second pillar, Dr. Whitaker, is entrepreneurship. And I love that piece so much because, you know, we're the largest consumer. African Americans are the largest consumer in the nation. We spent $1.2 trillion in 2019, more than any other race, more than any other community. However, we're only 12% of the population. And we only have 8 to 10% of small businesses, but we're the largest consumer. And so my organization, we focus on building entrepreneurs in communities of color, particularly Black communities. How do we help students at young ages talking about middle school and high school, develop financial literacy skills, develop entrepreneurial skills, right? And then create businesses post-college or post-high school and post-college, because every student of color is not going to go to college, and that's fine. But every student of color should own something. They should own something, right? Because you talk about having a seat at the table. Well, if you don't own anything, it's hard to have a influential seat at the table. And I'll pause with that. I think I've been talking a bunch.
No. I appreciate that. I've always heard, and obviously as an educator, I'm cognizant of the fact that not every child will go to college or has to go to college, but this is what I love about conversing with you because you stretch my thinking. The way that you just articulated, not every student will go to college or not every adult will go to college, but everybody deserves to own something. I think that's important. And then that also involves changing the trajectory as it relates to how Black folks and white folks think about the intellectual capabilities, in this case of Black students, in terms of their potential to do just that, to own. That makes a lot of sense to
me. Yeah, that ownership piece is important. You know, I'll tell you, I'll be honest, I didn't see too many owners, Black owners growing up. I don't know about you. And so ownership was not something in my mind that was an aspiration, right? Mm-hmm. What was an aspiration was I don't want to be in the projects anymore. I don't want to live in assisted living, assisted housing, you know, subsidized. I don't want to do that anymore. And so the step up from that might be, well, I can live in the suburbs outside of the city, but I'm still renting, right? To me, and as we were growing up, that was a win. That was success. It wasn't until I got around, like I said, I'm very cultured, other folks, white folks in particular, who was like, hey, why don't you own? You're actually spending more money renting than you are owning.
Right.
And so when I was able to sit down with individuals who understood the game, Dr. Whitaker, right, understood the game. That's the one thing about communities of color. We don't know the game. And if I can just speak parenthetically and just openly for just for a minute, you know, and take off my professional hat for a second, you know, out in the streets, we don't understand the game.
No, Dr. Oxley, listen, I don't mean to cut you off, but remember the title of my show is What's Really Going On? That's what we do. We hold my audience accounts on us to tell them what other folks won't tell them. So let's go ahead. Let's crank it up now.
Yeah. So the game, I mean, it's not, you know, moving out of the city into the suburbs and continue renting. You know, here's the real game. The game is going back into the hood you was born and raised in and buying a block. Buying a block and then building homes and then selling or renting out your homes to your community, community who on your block, there's a standard. There's a standard to live on your community. There's a standard to live on your block. And you can create that standard, right? I think that because we've seen so many of our cities become so gentrified, I think that has been such a downplay and such an adverse effect to our spirits in the black community. It feels like we're being pushed out of a place. We're not being welcome anymore in a place. And so my thought is, well, why are so many of us who are successful, why are we leaving? We're leaving because we're still stuck in this slave mentality. Oh, I gotta make it out. Instead of harnessing an empowered mentality, I gotta go back in. Right?
Right.
So when I left my PhD program, it wasn't I gotta stay out the city. It was like how the hell do I make it back in? I gotta go back into the city. And then I wanna be able to build something, right? And empower my people in ways in which, you know, we haven't been empowered. And one of those ways is through ownership. It's not just ownership in a home, but now I'm talking about ownership in a business. If we're the largest consumer, Dr. Whitaker, on the planet, why don't we own anything? It ain't because we don't have the money.
It's the mentality, the access. You know, it's interesting because when you were talking, I was just thinking about the fact that black men and women, but more specifically black women, are not represented in STEM. And you may say, well, Doc, how does that connect? I'm going to make the connection for us. At the University of Vanderbilt, or Vanderbilt University, began to study black females' interest in STEM, students, high school students. And Dr. Otley, what they discovered after interacting with black high school students, they said, we are interested in STEM, but we don't necessarily want to be aerospace engineers. They said, we want to study STEM. Here we go, culturally responsive pedagogy, right? They said, we want to study STEM in school, in high school, at the university level, to the extent that the curricular objectives relevant to this work allows us to solve issues that matter in our community. These students said things like, several students, as I begin to continue in research, the black female students were saying things like, my mother's minding her business, driving to work every single day, and next thing I know, she gets a ticket from a red light lamp, if that's what you call it, and it says she didn't stop, but she did. These females are saying, we want to study the development of those stoplights because it negatively impacts our community. What I want to add to that is at the University of Michigan, they have recently introduced the term referred to as the study of domocology. And the study of domocology is the study, watch this, Dr. Otley, of abandoned buildings that exist in inner cities. And what they did in Detroit, where they launched this project, Dr. Otley, and listening audience, is they went and they took students into the field and began to study the wood. Found is that 70%, so you know I work in one of those amazing communities in terms of people's potential, but not so positive in terms of the fact that I can drive 2 miles and see mostly abandoned houses. Here's where I'm going with this, to add value to what you said already. We have to change our mindset as educators and those that contribute to the field of education as it relates to being clear about how important it is, in this case, to get students out of the classroom, get them to places like the University of Michigan, get them learning about what to do with the wood in the abandoned houses in their communities, which they learned could actually be renovated, and it could actually be used again, and they could actually make money off of it. So as opposed to driving, I mean, I just had a paradigm shift in thinking when I began to learn about domacology, because now, as opposed to riding through the community thinking, oh, my God, look at those abandoned houses. There's no money there. So there's money there. But we have to teach our students, again, about research terms like study of domacology and how they can use skills, practical and theoretical skills, to build their community so that they can own. Dr. Otley, will you respond to that?
Yeah, well, first I want to respond to the STEM piece. In Black women, I think that's, you know, paramount. Even I think about my daughter. I mean, what will she go into when she goes to college? Does she want to go to college? She may say, Daddy, I want to just do this entrepreneurship thing. Or I don't want to go to college. So my spirit is just open to whatever she decides that she wants to do. But here's the caveat. I just want to expose her to everything so that she can make a good decision for herself. So when you think about STEM and young girls, even within our organization, we just put in a grant for money so that we can help students of color, particularly Black girls, in the STEM fields to introduce them to that world. That is an untapped world, Dr. Whitaker. There is so many opportunities for communities of color, particularly young Black girls, to get into those programs and to become somebody so amazing in the STEM fields. If you look at the numbers, it's like 90% of the STEM fields are white, right? And right. Then even breaking down the other numbers, it's just a very small percentage who are African-American. So when I say it's wide open, what I'm saying is there's so much opportunity for Black women to also thrive in this particular space. Black women are the largest group who are enrolled in college. Look at the numbers, two-year institutions, four-year institutions. The numbers are there, right, that Black women are enrolling in college in more ways than other communities. But then you wonder, like, well, why is, you know, Black women still struggling when it comes to what they make coming out of college, their first entry-level positions, what they make over, you know, the first 10 years of being in the professional position? Well, you also have to go back to look at, well, what are Black women studying? What are they majoring in? And then what types of jobs are they getting right after college, right? That's the other thing. We spend so much time talking about the numbers, but then we don't understand the data, right? And so as a researcher and scholar, I look at the data to really understand, well, yes, Black women are the most enrolled cohort of all cohorts right now, but they're just not going into some of the fields that are paying out some of these larger top dollars, right? And the STEM field is wide open, and the STEM field pays lots of money. There's programs now that I've researched that are implementing STEM programs for young Black girls in middle school and in high school to properly prepare them for some of those rigors in college and to properly prepare them for, you know, careers in the STEM. So my encouragement to those who are listening, yes, encourage your Black daughter, encourage your friends who have Black daughters, push them into STEM programs that is super wide open, super available. There's so many opportunities for growth and expansion there.
So, Dr. Otley, thank you for that. There's so much to talk about. I want to continue to ride this for just a second. What we're talking about is really wanting to raise the conscious level of the students in terms of their ability, their belief in their ability to do the work, right? To raise the conscious level of the teachers, the instructors, those who provide instruction on a daily basis to our students. And so I believe that this moves us closer to the term pedagogy or culturally responsive pedagogy. Can you describe from your perspective and or using your research knowledge what the term pedagogy or culturally responsive pedagogy means to you and how that relates to this topic, particularly as it relates to the topic of our show today, which is what does it take to catapult this equity work to the next level?
Yeah, culturally responsive pedagogy in its most simplistic terms, just think about your experience, those who are listening, your experience in grade school, high school, and even college. You know, how many times did you have a teacher or professor of color? And then on top of that, how many times did you have books, whether they be textbooks, whether they be novels that you read in class, lesson plans that were centered around current events that related to different cultures outside of the dominant culture? How many times were you exposed to books and texts and lessons and cultural artifacts and trips that you took on the yellow school bus when we were going on field trips, right, that centered on cultural diversity? That's what cultural relevant pedagogy is. It is the need to provide all of those pieces culturally inside of the classroom. And the dominant culture for so long has taught the text or provided literature or curated lesson plans around the dominant culture, the perspective and the lens of whites, the perspective and the lens of white educators, the perspective and lens of whites who are in positions of power and influence. And so culturally relevant pedagogy, it takes a shift and allows students and then teachers and then leaders and facilitators to see the responsiveness and the leadership, the innovation, right, the professionalism, the expertise, if you will, of other cultures. There are great doctors and authors and inventors who are people of color, and we rarely hear about them. And even if we hear about them, they're still told through a dominant perspective, through the dominant lens. Bringing in culturally relevant texts and books allows you to see the perspective from those individuals and those communities, right? And so there's a high need for that because certainly our world is more diverse than it's ever been before. And you see in the workforce development, there are certainly it's more diverse. You see in our school districts, it's 50% students of color. But these students, Dr. Werdecker, they don't see anybody that looks like them in the classroom. So there's a shortage of teachers of color, number one, right? There's a huge shortage. And then there's a lot of research that shows that. And then there's a lot of reasons that you and I could probably talk about on future shows about why there is such a shortage. People think, oh, because communities of color don't want to teach. No. One of the major reasons is because communities of color never feel accepted in the workplace.
Exactly.
Right? And so it's all about belonging. And if I don't feel like I belong somewhere, peace, deuces, I'm out. I'm going to try to find something else, right? And so there has not been this intentional creation of sense of belonging for communities of color in many of these workforces in education. But going back just to the pedagogy, you know, just the need, if you don't have the teachers who are of color, because all students should have and be exposed to someone who looks like them, and research shows white students do better when they have teachers who are also of color. It ain't just a black thing. Even white students are performing better and have a better lens on life when they have been exposed to teachers of color, right? So if you don't have the teachers of color, the thing that you can do in the immediate is to bring in culturally relevant pedagogy. Make sure that things in your lesson plans and your curriculum speak to different cultures through their lens and not the lens of the dominant race.
Very well said, Dr. Otley. This past week, I hosted, actually I was a speaker. I mentioned on my last show at a state-level event, which was sponsored by IASA, the Illinois Association of School Administrators, and I co-presented on the topic of what's race got to do with it. And I want to connect it to the content that you just put into the atmosphere, relevant to the point that I have been overwhelmed in a good way by the number of teachers, white teachers in particular, who reached out to me as a direct result of me saying to hundreds of them that two things I said, you don't have to look like your student. You don't have to be a black teacher, in other words, to be an effective teacher of children of color. But then I said, don't get it twisted now. I want to be clear about the fact that black students have to and must have access, and white students have to and must have access to black teachers. However, we do recognize that over 80% of the teaching profession is made up of white female teachers who have to be able to implement culturally responsive pedagogy within their respective classrooms. So I think that I guess the only thing I'm doing right now is really adding value to what you've already said about how important it is to do so. I appreciate.
Dr. Whitfield, can I just pause you just for a second and just share this one thing?
Please,
would you mind? So when you were talking about the number of white females who are educators, the question, no one asked the question, but why? Why is there only mostly predominantly white women who are educators? And so while communities of color have a hard time pushing into education and staying very long, retention is very low for teachers of color. Part of that is the welcome and a sense of belonging. But here's the other piece, the financial piece, because teachers do not make a whole lot of money. The research shows that the reason, one of the reasons that white women have been able to position themselves as educators for years, even though the pay has not been great, is because they're married to somebody who makes substantially more money than they make. And so and so as educators, they don't rely on the check to pay the rent or to pay the mortgage. But the check simply is for vacations in the summer. The check is simply for retirement, 401k. The check are simply for helping, you know, their son or daughter get through college, right? When you look at the black community and you think about teachers, the pay is not enough to cover the rent a lot of times. And also within the dynamic of the family unit, you know, many black women compared to white women are married to somebody who is bringing in excessively more than they make. So they can't look at the education job as a supplement pay, right? No. This is primary pay, right? So I think that we also need to restructure and how we pay our teachers. Our teachers should be, you know, paid way more. I mean, our teachers are producing presidents of the United States.
Right.
Why the hell are they not paying teachers more than that? And so I just want listeners to know, not only is the sense of belonging for communities of color a lack of sense of belonging, but also it's pay.
Listen, Dr. Otley, we're on live, and I feel like I just need to sit for a minute and reflect on what you just said. In fact, we're going to take – this will be a good time for a quick break, a two-minute commercial break, and we're going to come back and finish this dialogue. But I have never – heard anyone describe the absence of black teachers, one of the variables, in the way that you have just done. Never. That was powerful. Stay with me for just a minute. We're going to pause for a quick break, okay?
Are you ready to take your equity work to the next level? Are you serious about better ensuring that your teaching and administrative staff move beyond knowing that inequities exist in America's schools to actually setting achievable goals relevant to changing the way they teach so as to better meet the academic, social, and emotional needs of the diverse population of students served? If so, the book entitled Is There Anybody Who Can Teach Me How to Read? Practical Strategies for Dramatically Improving Student Learning, written by Dr. Sonia Whitaker, is a must-have for your principals, assistant principals, and teaching staff. In this book, Dr. Whitaker shows your teachers how to enhance your equity initiatives by incorporating more culturally responsive teaching practices throughout their daily lessons. Most books we just read and do the best we can to apply the knowledge. This, however, is no ordinary book. Your staff will not be able to put the book down because it has intentionally been written to engage your staff in deep reflection in every chapter of the book so as to enhance or transform, where needed, the manner in which they deliver instruction. You see, it is imperative that your equity work includes better ensuring that your entire teaching staff knows what culturally responsive teaching actually looks like at the instructional level, also known as the implementation of culturally responsive pedagogy, so that their efforts outside of initial district-wide and school-wide professional development actually results in improvements in teaching and learning. For easy access in purchasing a copy of the book, simply visit soniawhitaker.com. You may also purchase copies of the book on Amazon, and for phone orders, dial 1-800-468-7998. 1-800-468-7998.
Greetings and good morning, listening audience. Thank you very much for staying with us. For those who have just jumped onto the radio show today, I am in a live broadcast with Dr. Jason Otley. Dr. Otley is the executive director for the Bond Educational Group, a nonprofit organization that invests in the lives of underserved communities through education and entrepreneurship. We're going to continue the second half of our conversation here. We talked a lot about the implementation of culturally responsive pedagogy, which I'm going to have us elaborate on in just a moment. We've talked about the absence of Black teachers in the profession. I would highly encourage you to get the on-demand version of this particular radio broadcast so that you can increase your knowledge with regards to multiple ways and multiple perspectives by which to view and understand better why the absence of Black teachers actually exists in the profession. I asked Dr. Otley to give to us his definition or understanding of the term culturally responsive pedagogy. He did so. I want to add, Dr. Otley, that Kristen Colan, the author of Pedagogy in Education, indicates that pedagogy refers to teaching methods, including teaching styles, feedback, and assessment. She says that while each teacher has a different pedagogical approach to learning in their classroom, they should consider the most effective means of content based on student needs. Matthew Lynch indicates that culturally responsive pedagogy is the approach that we take to come to terms with who we are culturally and the extent to which we are deeply aware of how our cultural experiences impact our perceptions and or biases. And that's where I want to go next. Dr. Matthew Lent describes for us what he refers to as three functional dimensions of culturally responsive pedagogy. He refers to the personal dimension, which is the examination of beliefs, the institutional dimension, which occurs at the board level and the superintendent level as it relates to the development and the implementation of more culturally responsive policies and practices, which we'll talk about. And we've already talked a little bit about the third dimension, which is the instructional dimension, which occurs at the classroom level. So for those of you who are taking notes, because a lot of my listening audience takes notes, note that, again, the three functional dimensions of culturally responsive pedagogy, as is indicated by Dr. Matthew Lynch, is the personal dimension, the institutional dimension, and the instructional dimension. And you can check off instructional dimension because, in my humble estimation, we have talked about that a little bit already. Dr. Otley, I want to talk about the personal dimension of culturally responsive pedagogy, which is specific to the examination of beliefs. School districts across the country, after the death of George Floyd, and many before, but I was Floyd rather, on national and international television, began to embrace this idea or notion that they needed to be more culturally responsive. And so as a direct result of that, they began to call in people like me and you and our peers to engage their staff in training. in my humble estimation, one of the first steps as it relates to developing one's cultural competencies is knowledge of self-culture. And so my direct question to you would be, how important, again, at the exploring of self-culture dimension of culture-responsive pedagogy, how important do you think it is that black educators and white educators and brown educators engage in the process of coming to terms with who they are, their background, and how that impacts how they interact with black children? How important is that?
It's fundamentally important, Dr. Whitaker, and I think that not only is it important, we as a people, and I'm talking about the human race, we struggle just in communication, period. We're not good communicators. We're not effective communicators. And so when we look at how communities of color, more specifically, need to be treated better in our school systems, there needs to be a communication about that, about the treatment. However, because we already struggle as a human race in communication, that's probably one of the first fundamentally sound issues. And so it's incumbent upon educators like you and I and others across the nation who have been trained to communicate effectively. That's where it begins, right? So at the Bond Educational Group, we're trained communicators. We all have great degrees, but at the foundation, we communicate very well. And so we go into school districts and we assist school districts with the language of great communication.
Wow.
And so once you set that foundation, then you can have these much needed conversations on how do you talk about race and how do you talk about difference and how do you talk about exclusion? How do you talk about access? How do you talk about the historical underpinnings that are rooted in our policy? How do you talk about how this country was built on the backs of slaves? Like how do you have those uncomfortable conversations in spaces that are predominantly white, but you serve predominantly students of color, right? First is being an effective communicator. Secondly is being comfortable with uncomfortable conversation. And think about a relationship, though, Dr. Whitaker. Mm-hmm. In relationships, we tend to sweep the hard things under the rug, or we tend to say, oh, we'll get to it later, right?
Right.
But the problem is later usually comes quicker than many of us think. And then when we sweep it under the rug, it creates an even bigger problem that we have to address later on down the road, right? So rather than sweep this thing under the rug, or rather than assume somebody else is going to, you know, pick up and fix it, or rather assume that our jobs are safe even if we don't address it, we should be thinking the opposite. How can I get in this work? How can I be a better communicator with my staff and my team? How can I create an environment where everybody in this space feels open to share, that their voice is heard? And then once we do that, how can we start to intertwine some of these conversations around culturally relevant pedagogy and make it personal, right? And make it super personal, personal to the point where you don't take off your cultural lens when you leave the parking lot and you drive back into suburbia and you go home to, you know, your family. Like, you should be able to keep that cultural hat on. It should become a lifestyle. If you're part of the dominant culture, you should not be able to leave your school building and go home and not think about your students of color. Something should push you while you're home at dinner, when you're home playing with your kids, when you're home, you know, thinking about your next vacation. Something should really on the inside begin to have you answer the question, have you done enough today? Is there more you could have done, right? And I think when we get to that place, Dr. Whitaker, where we stop treating communities of color as a 9-to-5 job, but we start treating communities of color as you're part of my world and this is my life, then I think we'll start to see the needle moves more in education. And who's going to be in charge of that needle movement? It's going to be educators. I'm sorry, y'all looking at all these other people, policymakers, y'all looking at all these other folks, you know, entrepreneurs and big businesses and all these great people who are doing some great things. they're not going to be able to move the needle when it comes to a cultural shift in thinking. That has to take place in education, and it's incumbent upon our educators to adopt change, to adopt, to embrace difference as a lifestyle as opposed to a 9-to-5.
I agree with that. You know, two things that you just said that really resonate in my spirit right now. I'm taking notes. I feel like I'm in class also. You said we've got to get to a point where we're thinking about these students, the community, the students that we have to serve, particularly black students in this instance, beyond 9-to-5. Aren't you and I, Dr. Otley, doing this beyond 9-to-5, right?
We are. I mean, I live and breathe this. Yeah, I live and breathe it. It's 24/7, weekends too. Right.
Right. But when people say they want to take their organizations to the next level, we started out at the beginning of the show today talking about how precious time is. How much time are you actually putting into this? So you are a part of my world, and this is my life that stood out to me. And then I want to address what you said. What is the language of great communication? And one of the things, and then I'll have you talk a little bit about your equity summit and then let the listening audience know how to reach out to you and your team, because clearly we need help with this work, okay? But what I want to say with regards to the language of great communication, what I have discovered in interacting with educators nationwide is a part of it, and you can tell me if you agree or not, Dr. Otley, is really about people being afraid. I mean, during right before our last president left office, he issued an executive order, and a lot of people went to sleep on that. At the national level, he issued an executive order that would essentially have made it illegal for us to engage in conversations like this on my radio show. And in fact, the day when I presented several months ago at the state level, I actually showed the school district leaders a copy of that executive order, which essentially said during the last president's term that we could not engage in conversation about cultural competencies and the like. And if we did, the federal funds that were being allocated to our school districts, which we need to do the work, would be stripped. That we could not use those dollars. And so when you make the statement relevant to what is the language of great communication, I think my mind actually goes to the fact that people are afraid to communicate. And the fact that, you know, all the way at the federal government level since the beginning of time, there have been strategic efforts put forth to make sure that actually does not happen. Would you like to respond to that and then take us right into the work that you've done relevant to the Equity Summit and what you're most proud of about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that memorandum or executive order certainly caused pause for many organizations and educators who do this work that you and I do, Dr. Whitaker. I didn't get nervous about it. I knew it wouldn't be anything that would stick. I just felt in my heart of hearts that the people would vote against that eventually, or there would be just a shift or a change. So it didn't last very long, but it certainly was something that made us all pause for a minute and make us a little nervous. But now that is no longer, I think that there is now just this desire for more conversations and more trainings. We at the Bond Educational Group, we get calls, emails every week. Can we come to this training? Can we meet with leaders? And most of the trainings that we do are with the superintendent's office, which would be inclusive of the principals too, right? So a lot of the training that I have seen done,
talk about that.
Yes, a lot of the training that I've seen done, and you've seen this too, you know, you do professional development and you meet with teachers and, you know, you help them within the classroom, which is great, and that's so needed. But I wasn't seeing the training being done on the level where decisions were made and policies could be rewritten, right? And so our training is primarily with superintendents and their offices because we recognize that's where the power is. And so if we're able to help them to communicate around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then include language in their policy, particularly with the board too, right? So you've got the superintendent office, but then you've got the board. And every time the board members come in and they, you know, have this new idea about different goals for the school district, that's what gets trickled down into our schools, right? We gotta go to the top and affect the top. So we do that work with a lot of our superintendents. And it was just so great to have you as part of the Equity Summit here just a couple of weeks ago. We just hosted our first annual event and had an amazing turnout. We had educators from across the country, 32 different states to be exact when I pulled the numbers. And so you led a session, Dr. Whitaker, with other superintendents. Now that I'm speaking about supers, you led a session with superintendents from across the nation, and it was one of our most attended sessions. And I believe it was most attended by a lot of our leaders, right? A lot of our supers who were across the nation thinking about, well, what am I supposed to be doing with all of these things that are taking place? My leaders are asking me about, can I allow my teachers to talk about current events? Can we talk about George Floyd? How do we recruit differently? How do we go after, you know, teachers of color? How do we infuse culturally relevant pedagogy? That stuff doesn't happen at the principal level. Mm-hmm. That stuff doesn't happen at the teacher level. That stuff has to happen at the very top and trickles down. And so I'm grateful that, you know, within the Equity Summit we had over 140 speakers, over three power-packed days, right? It was so many people who had attended and were involved in that, 47 different sessions. We're super excited about next year. It'll always be in February because it's Black History Month, right? And so we're moving it. We're virtual. Those who are listening, we are virtual. We were virtual this year. We'll continue to be virtual because we want to be able to not only get the 32 states we had this past year, we want all 50 states, and then we want to be able to go global. These conversations around equity need to be global conversations. And so those who are listening are wondering, well, what's so different about your summit and you know, why is your conference so different than everybody else's? Well, I'll tell you, as an educator who's been to 1,001 conferences and I presented 1,001 times, I am always in a space where people are talking about the problem and spend the last 5 minutes talking about solutions.
Exactly.
The Equity Summit does the reverse. We spend the entire time talking about solutions. And people who are coming, who are our speakers, they are charged. They know. I handpicked, Dr. Whitaker, all 140 speakers.
I told
it was
you
no
did,
review
doctor.
Process. Yeah, it was no review test. Process, no proposal. No. I handpicked everyone and spoke on the phone with everyone and said, the Equity Summit, we're not spending time talking about the problem. The world knows the problem. You need to come with your solutions, even if your solutions were failed attempts. We want you to talk about that because it is in our failed attempts we can help other people not make the same mistake.
Powerful, powerful.
So,
Dr. Osley,
yeah,
listen,
yeah.
I feel like we have just gotten started, and can you believe we have 5 minutes left? We've got to do this again. I'm going to put you on the spot on this with my national audience and ask you at some point in our lifetime, let's reconnect on the airway again. I actually look forward to supporting you in any way I can, particularly as it relates to your next summit. I want to give you a minute or two to tell folks how to get in contact with you, and then I'll end by putting a plug in for the event we're hosting this week. Oh, my goodness, 6 days from now. So how might they contact you?
Yeah, super excited about the event in 6 days. Thank you for that invitation. But you can contact me. Email is Otley@thebond, and Otley is Bajan. My father's from Barbados. It's spelled Ottley. Otley@thebond.org. You can also contact us on thebond.org is our website, and also at theequitysummit.com. You Google Equity Summit. We're going to be the first link. I mean, pop in there. Look at all the great speakers we had. Yours truly, Dr. Sonia Whitaker, is on there. Again, led a phenomenal session with superintendents. And you'll see all the other speakers who were there for this past year's event. And stay tuned to that particular website because we're about to roll out next year's summit in March. Our planning team meets this Monday the 22nd. We've got a debrief from the Equity Summit, and then in March we start planning and looking to increase our tickets by 125%. Those who are looking to give to an organization where the proceeds go back into undeserved communities. We're looking to raise even more money this year, and those proceeds go into communities of color who have a lack of resources. And you may ask, Dr. Whitaker, what are we doing in those communities of color? We are taking bright minds like yours into these communities and providing superintendents, principals, teachers, staff, students. We're providing them with free resources, knowledge, and experience, and the how-to. We're providing all of that free with all the proceeds that we're able to raise. So many people, and I'm going to end with this, many people like think about communities of color and lack of resources, and philanthropists, venture capitalists will send things like smart boards to communities of color. I used to work in D.C. public school systems, a charter school in particular, where we had received smart boards, Dr. Whitaker, but those smart boards remain in a closet because nobody knew how to put it together and nobody
Correct.
Knew how to use it, right?
Correct.
So stop saying
right.
things. You want to really help communities of color? Start empowering and then putting monies in the pockets of those like Dr. Whitaker to go into these cities, right, and then
right.
provide the resources, the how-to, the wherewithals, because you just sending products doesn't help move the needle. You sending capital, as in people, helps move the needle. So I appreciate
Ooh,
you allowing me to be
that,
part of your show.
I think that on that note, sending the people, the capital, that is so powerful. Said everybody, this show actually doesn't end, does it, Dr. Otley? We're going to take this show on the road next week in my role as National Education Policy Director for Push Excel, which is an affiliation of the Rainbow Push Coalition, in which our founder, Reverend Jesse Jackson, serves as leader. On this Thursday, February 25th, from 6:30 p.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time, with all this brain capacity, we're going to give you this event for free. We're asking you to go to pushexcel.org to sign up so that you can hear from me, Dr. Otley, Superintendent Joliet School District 204, Dr. Carla Guzman, also Dr. Sharon Carratt, Superintendent Peoria School District in Illinois. We're going to bring the roof off the place on Thursday, so we look forward to having you continue the work. And then Dr. Otley, as he has indicated, he's given you information about his next Equity Summit. Follow his work. He is on my show today because he is talented and his organization is doing the work. So let's get him in so that we can accomplish exactly what we talked about relevant to the topic of this show, which is what does it take to catapult your equity work to the next level. Dr. Otley, thank you so much. I consider it an honor and a blessing to have had you in my space today. Make it a great day.
Thank you, Dr. Whitaker.
Thank you for tuning in to WRGO. What's really going on? Be sure to log into my website at SoniaWhitaker.com in order to listen live again next Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time and to gain access to the on-demand version of this broadcast and many others. Remember, this is not my radio show. This is our radio show, and your thoughts matter to me. Therefore, I'm inviting you to share with me topics that you would like to see covered in my Saturday morning broadcast. Please consider sending me your show ideas and topics by visiting my website at SoniaWhitaker.com and providing your thoughts in the Contact Us section. And remember, when you operate in your gift, you don't have to be at the head of the table. For wherever you sit or stand, the table will shift.